Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John McMurtry. Oh, we will have a very, very riveting hour, I guarantee that. We'll talk about a few things. Of course, the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, the war of aggression that the fascists in Kiev, the ones that Washington, Obama, and his minions put into power, the war of aggression without mercy they're waging on Ukrainians in the east, including civilians, including murdering them in cold blood, sometimes individually, sometimes en masse like they did, murdering 300 Odessans on the 2nd of May, with whitewashing the entire story, twisting the truth, turning it on its head on what went on, including the severity, including who was responsible. The worst part of it was blaming victims for their own demise, if you can imagine that. That's exactly what went on. That's the kind of rubbish that you get from Ukraine, from the U.S. media, and you certainly don't get it on this program. We'll talk a little bit about the situation in Venezuela. Again, a Washington-manipulated violent situation on the streets in very selected areas to get rid of the probably the most democratically elected government on the planet, and Washington wants to get rid of it and impose the same kind of fascists in Venezuela that they imposed on the Ukrainians in Ukraine. And we'll talk a little bit about the Indian election. They had an election. John, let's start off with that. I was amazed. I wrote an article this morning. I called it India's Sham Democracy. My God, I mean, it's basically, India runs its country basically like America, except they have more political parties. There are two major ones that dominate. This time, the second one, the Congress Party, I believe came in third. But they have a lot of little parties. At most, they turn out to be junior coalition partners. But the Hindu ultra-nationalist BJP party won and got a clear majority, which is very unusual in India. And there's going to be nothing but trouble ahead for the Indian people. Modi, the new prime minister, he was the minister in Gujarat province. And in 2002, he was the guy responsible for unleashing a massacre, a pogrom that killed maybe 2,000 Muslims, injured maybe 2,000 or 3,000 more. And he was totally exonerated by a special committee set up by India's Supreme Court. Sounds like America's Supreme Court, John. Literally whitewashing his crimes and absolving him of any responsibility.
Well, basically, they asked him for his side of the story. That was it.
That's it. That's exactly
it's just
it.
It's a travesty, complete travesty.
A complete travesty is right. And of course,
you know,
Congress Party.
Sorry, you go ahead, Steve. Just on India, I've been, you know, I've traveled the length and breadth of India, and the BJP, the one I was there for, you know, backpacking 100 days from the Himalayas down to the tip. The BJP was just getting started then. It was a fundamentalist party, and the fundamentalists of the U.S., economic fundamentalists, or the Tea Party, are to the U.S., so is the BJP to India. It's based upon religious principles. So already you've got the idea of a theocratic state, which, as you know, is widespread in the Middle East as well, but it can't call itself. It has to run through secular elections, but it's basically a Hindu fundamentalist party. Now, Hinduism is often understood, and rightfully so, as being a non-violent and anti-violent, you know, especially through Gandhi's influence, but it goes way back 2,500 years as a non-violent religion. But in fact, it isn't at all, and the Indian, I would say, tends to be a more peaceful in the individual, in my own experience, whereas in the collective or in the mass or in the mob, it's a beast. It's a dangerous beast. And he presided, as you rightly said, over a massacre of hundreds and hundreds of Islamic people. But there's a feeling, there's a hostility between Islam and Hinduism, Hindu fundamentalism in particular, that goes way back to the founding of the country. The fact that the country was split into Pakistan and India has been led to civil war, and still it's an ongoing civil war in the Kashmir Valley, for example. So you have a built-in hatred working there, except that there's 200 million Muslims. That's more than, you know, that's almost the population of the United States inside India, Islamic. And they, you know, there are these pogroms. When I was there, it was during the Bombay riots, where thousands of people were being murdered. Mm-hmm. And I was also in Benares, and the screaming fundamentalist rhetoric and demagoguery that was going on was something to behold. I mean, just thousands and thousands of people. And I remember I couldn't bear it. It was just like watching Nazism unfold in front of your eyes. And so I actually stood up on a table and started haranguing back. And it was interesting that because I was white and because, you know, people didn't want to mess with me. But what I noticed was a lot of people very silently nodded, caught my eye and nodded to me that I was onto something, but it was too frightening to confront if you were a native Indian. So this guy, Modi, is now the guy who was leading the, you know, held responsible for those massacres in Gujarat, is now the first minister, and he's the first minister, the prime minister of the whole country, and he is with a majority. The first time we've had a majority, that means any opposition party that usually, I always think that in Canada especially, but also elsewhere, you're always better to have a minority government because it keeps them balanced with other constituencies participating in the policy formation. But we have none of this. For the first time, basically, in India's history, we have a complete majority, first time since early history, a complete majority in this guy Modi's hand. But not only is Modi known as a fundamentalist, this is what's distressing about him, because you never read in the paper, as you know, it's possible to regiment the public mind every bit as much as an army regiments its bodies, and that's the founder of, those are the words, of course, of Bernays, and if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, it's possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without them ever knowing it. Now that is the founder of public relations, Edward Bernays, a nephew of Freud in the 1920s, 1932, 1928, in that period. And that's what's happened not only inside India, but that's across the world. Nobody really knows what this guy stands for other than fundamentalism, but worse, he stands for the Americanization of the Indian economy. He had a glowing report from Wall Street Journal as soon as he got elected, and the idea was that, you know, he's going to lay off. India has a very highly developed generic drugs industry. And that was something, by the way, that I experienced myself, you know, because I got sick there with a different, you know, polluted water, all kinds of things that pose problems to a Western stomach. And you could get generic drugs for almost nothing there. And that he's going to turn that all around. He's going to be a sweetheart of the big pharma, and the Wall Street Journal's praising him for that. He's also going to, India's tried to, you know, as they do in the pharma market, and they are really big there. They export a lot of their generic drugs. It's a very, very important part of the economy. He's promising to turn that around. He's also doing it with wind power. They're trying to develop an Indian-based alternative green energy sector, and he's going to turn that around and going to allow all the the exports coming from the U.S. into it with no protection of their manufacturing. And he's very big on intellectual property. So all the intellectual property disputes and ways of cramming down the throat of what in fact is pirating by the U.S. of other people's seeds, especially in India, he seems to be on the side of all that. In short, he's under the mask of fundamentalism. It's always a mask. we are having the same neoliberal, to put it mildly, program now being instituted or about to be instituted in India without people really knowing. Well, I mean, it just hasn't arisen as an issue. The only way one knows about it is when the Wall Street Journal praises it. So intellectual property is going to be something there as well. Furthermore, and that's the last point I'll make with Modi, with things to watch out for, is India is a very deep partner of Russia, especially in high technology and in defense spending. And that's also looks like it will open to the U.S. and there'll be definitely an attempt to divide that relationship, which is actually long-standing right from the beginning of India's birth, a long-standing relationship of friendship with Russia. And that will be reversed, and that may be even the most significant thing of all on the global stage.
What's going on, John, is very disturbing, and a good question listeners might ask is, why is India so important? Well, India is the second largest country in the world in population next to China. Both countries have over 1 billion people. India is supposedly called the world's largest democracy. Well, I would call it the world's largest sham democracy. It's like America is a sham democracy, a Western European country, the new Eastern European ones. Well, you know, the former Soviet republics and Warsaw Pact countries, sham democracies in the Western orbit following U.S. diktats and so on.
Well, yeah, even more sham. I mean, the corruption there is, something beyond what we've experienced.
Oh, indeed.
The worst
indeed.
Here. And they, indeed, it's just the standard language is what they call vote banks, which is basically who can you bank on getting votes from, and basically you bank on them through bribery. And so it's just the language of banking and of commerce and currency and the purchase of votes and so forth is just sort of built into the culture. And then, you know, who gets the positions? He's going to replace, you know, they'll do a mighty winding down. They'll do a lot to eliminate civil service positions and replace them with their own hacks. And the corruption is so alienating, really. I mean, when you'd see these poobahs come in, as I say, I traveled through the bloodstreams of the people, so to speak, for 100 days. When you'd see these people come into a town or a city who are politicians, you just think they just corruption ooze. Corruption, privilege, and arrogance ooze from them every step they took as a special caste. Remember, that's maybe the most important thing about India that seems to be run into its moral DNA, its caste system. And that's something that we don't talk about a lot, and they, you know, they've done actions to try to reverse the caste system, but it seems to be built right into the culture in a very, very basic way, which I could get into philosophically. They have a philosophical justification for it, which is that there should be rule by the superior, and each person does their function in accordance with what they were born to, and that you are born to the position you're in because of the karmic accumulation of your past ancestors and those who went before you. So you're basically, you know, it's the reincarnation doctrine. You're reincarnated in accordance with your past deeds, and your past deeds, if you're on the low end of things, your past deeds must have been evil. And so it's actually part of the Hindu holy writ is that you are to oppress the oppressed. That's your duty, because they have been bad in a past lifetime. So we have a real, really sick class system going on underneath, almost like a syntax there.
Well, indeed, John, it's a very, very tragic situation, and the Indians justifiably routed the ruling Congress party. They betrayed the Indian people so badly, they ended up.
But they're supposed to be the social democrat side, the left side, even the socialist side. I mean, that's the original party that got independence. That's the party of Gandhi and Nehru.
And, but they stress neoliberalism.
But they're corrupt.
That's what hurt them so badly. But the BJP is also a very strongly neoliberal party combined with Hindu ultranationalism. So Indians will get the worst of both worlds. Instead of throwing out the bums, they're inheriting worse bums. I quoted a wonderful line from Arundhati Roy. She talked about the promise of Congress or whatever to let the benefits trickle down to the people, and instead all they got was having them gush up. gush up to the elites of the country. And that's exactly what happened. The privileged elites of India, something like 100 of the Indian oligarchs, the combined wealth, I guess that's the best way to put it, the combined wealth or the combined equity amounts to 25% of India's GDP. 100 oligarchs,
and
25%.
And maybe more, you know, when you get underneath it all. I mean, the inequalities are immense. As my mother used to say, slime floats to the top. She was actually a conservative thinker. And that certainly has happened it's happened everywhere. Which country doesn't have a criminal now in a chief head office, either a convicted or a should-be convicted criminal? I mean, we have at this stage... We have basically a criminal gang rule, and it's hard to see where inside, in particular, the so-called West, where it isn't criminal. We seem to have something of a turnaround happening in possibly Russia, given the performance we've seen so far in this conflict. He's rather surprised me, Putin and the Russian. system has rather surprised me at how much more intelligent and non-warlike it is compared to the so-called West. I mean, on our side, in our corporate press, never is the other side presented as it is. Excuse me. Never. Whereas there, they tend to, like Putin would say, something like, you can't blame the people in Maiden Square but being tired of having one set of crooks replace another set of crooks. You never get that kind of balanced thinking. It's rather surprised me coming from Russia and Putin. And notice, too, how much is Putin threatened? The West never, and the U.S. and the EU never stop threatening. They don't utter a statement without a threat and an insult. And then you go to the other side and you say, well, how many threats and insults have we heard? We've only heard a description of a fact, which is that it's a fascist government, and we'll get into that. Like, it's, this is just a denotative term that most accurately defines the nature of this government. And so, and then even on the level of financial contracts and assets, who's violating them on the side of Russia and violating the assets of the West and violating the contracts they've set? Well, they just violated it well by the European Union and especially the U.S. Doesn't matter what the contracts are. Supposedly the essence of the free market, indeed the great leap forward, you might say, historically, is contractual relations being sustained. Those don't matter a thing. So and then you have hate campaigns, just hate, nonstop hate for, as we do in Venezuela, nonstop hate for Putin, which you call Putin bashing. Well, it's more than that. It's hate. They're just generating nonstop hate, conditioning it with every statement they give. Even the BBC and the Guardian, who are the most progressive elements in the English-speaking culture, still do it that way. And then you notice, well, who's in whose country? Who's on whose border threatening? And yet everything is reverse projected. All of these things are reverse projected onto Russia, so that you attack the other for projecting on them what you're doing yourself as a reason for attacking them. I mean, it's just so bizarre and it's so systematic. Like all of those elements that I just named, all of those trends, it's hard to find any exception for it. So we're really, every step that's being taken by the U.S. and the EU here is really another revelation of the criminal corruption of the whole thinking system. what they're willing to do. What they do is a matter of course. Only here we're up against something a little more than a people without any air defenses that is in a third world situation and no boots, really no ability to defend themselves. And indeed, once a world superpower, that's the only thing that's really changed here, and that's what's giving all the aggravation. I mean, I hate to say it as a moral philosopher, just think in terms of good and evil actually standing on either side. On one side, you see, you know, for the reasons I just gave, you see a kind of a reasonableness, and on the other side, you just see extremist hate, violation of agreements, continuous threatening, in right on others' borders, and the claim of terrorists for wanting elections, for doing elections. I don't know whether you're aware, because they're not publishing at all in the West, that they're bombing right now. They're artillery shelling Slavyansk. Did you know that?
Oh, well, I wrote about it. I have another article.
So, I mean, where did you find it out? I mean, you can't find any press that's carrying that.
Oh, well,
I mean,
it's been going on
since May 10th.
Well, you know, it's intermittent, John. In the Lugansk region, the Ukraine military basically has the city surrounded, and they're attacking the city at all sides. So far, the latest news I've gotten, and I keep checking a number of times a day, but the latest news I got included in my article written before the end of the day, if I have to, I'll update it a little bit, but they have not penetrated the heart of the city.
They haven't penetrated. They're just lobbing them on the outside, so the whole thing about they're doing it to dislodge the terrorists, that is
people wanting to vote. And they're holding the city under
siege. Went the day before and the day after they voted. It's punishment for their voting. And but they're not touching them. They're burning houses and killing people on the outskirts who've got nothing to do with it. So again, you get this fascist ring to the whole process. I mean, it just, if you go through, you know, the big lie as the method throughout. Just everything that's said is a lie. It's hard to find an exception that you get from the European or North American press or its political leaders. It's hard to find anything they say that is not a big lie. And all of the big lie operates in accordance with the reverse projection logic. It's hard to see anything that's said that isn't driven by hate. And I'm sort of going into the fascist dimensions of this. I mean, Russia, we're really experiencing, I mean, Russia's experiencing, it's not just now fascist. I mean, you've written this in your articles. You're very aware of it. You say it goes back to 1945. Well, it goes back to back to 1917 when they started putting in military units from all the West to crush the revolution.
Oh, indeed, you're right, John. I wrote about that in an earlier article.
Yeah.
With U.S. 8,000 Marines, Woodrow Wilson sent 8,000 Marines into
Canada
Russia.
Canada even sent in people. Japan sent in people. I mean, it was unbelievable just to crush the revolution right on the ground like they were doing. You know, the key is whether it's Venezuela or Ukraine or anywhere. The key is any economic organization for the social benefit, as opposed to multiplying money for money possessors, is going to be attacked. It's going to be attacked within the country. It's going to be attacked outside the country. It's going to be invaded. And that's why Russia is the special victim. People weren't invading it before 1917. They haven't stopped invading it. Then the whole Nazi, you can understand the whole Nazi interregnum itself as basically to destroy socialism in one country. Well, it was, you know, originally wanting to be an international movement. But basically, that's the way really of understanding why Hitler was able to break all the rules and laws of the Treaty of Versailles, one after another. He was encouraged to break them. He was armed by the West, by the U.S., by, you know, Ford and General Motors and IBM, etc. And they've been after to destroy Russia ever since 1917. And then it just never stops. You get the connection between the Nazis I mean, their information, their foreign information comes from, you know, the Fort Hunt Treaty, where they handed it all over for the impunity of their SS generals. They've handed over the information they had on the Soviet Union and indeed on the whole East. They handed that information that made up 70% of NATO's information at the time and, you know, had the death squad method. That's another thing. We see the death squad method. That's what's going on in the desert. They poisoned those people. They not only threw a burning gas bombs into the building and you were full of people, there was a poisoning of them, it appears. You can't explain how the people who got out still died. They were poisoned. And so, and if you watch the video of that, it's, you know, you hear a big bang in the middle of it, and you wonder what in the world has happened. And when people got out before they were shot or beaten to death or chased down and killed, which you've written about very well, they still fell down dead from the gas if they managed to get out of the building alive.
John, let me explain a little bit more about what actually went on. I wrote an article about the Odessa massacre, and I was wrong. I quoted information or cited information from Russian sources, from RT International, from Voice of Russia, that said something like 47 people or 48 were killed. There were dozens of others missing. Some were killed outside. But the real story came from eyewitnesses who were inside the building, the ones who escaped. Most of them were rounded up and later murdered. But what happened was the fire was cover-up. The right sector Nazi, neo-Nazis, were inside the building. They trapped 300 people or so inside the building. They murdered them in cold blood in the building. They shot them in the back of the head. They strangled them to death. They beat them to death. They chopped some up with axes, and nobody jumped out of windows. They were thrown out of windows, and something like 16 people escaped, and either all or most of them were rounded up afterwards, and they were murdered in cold blood, either shot or strangled or whatever.
Certainly murdered in cold blood in every case. But the one thing that the eyewitness account that I read that came from the fire commander in the area, he said we couldn't understand why people who hadn't yet been tracked down and murdered got out of the building and died, just fell down and died, unless it was poison gas. So, I mean, that's an eyewitness account from the fire commander himself. But of course, as in 9/11 and so on, you're never going to get, it's hard to get the real story. What we do know, which is the generic important fact, is there was a mass murder of these people. And that this went along with the mass murder that was found out to be all, you know, in the Maiden Square uprising when they were blaming the government for sniping people. They found out that the sniper came from the Pravi sector, the right sector. And so, you know, that got disclosed by the inside the EU diplomatic channels and leaked. So we never hear more about that either. So it's what we can conclude with certainty, though, is that they were viciously murdered in all the ways that we can associate with fascism. I've done a lot of work in fascism. 1983, I wrote an article, Fascism and Neoconservatism, Is There a Difference? Because I had a question mark. Because I could see so many similarities between what Reagan was up to and the chauvinism and the complete indifference to people suffering and so forth, and the patriarchy, etc. And that, you know, that's still an understanding that's out there. I would simplify it further today and say where you really know fascism is at work is when it overrides people's right to life at will. And not only overrides people's right to life at will, but by mass murder. No problem with it. This is what we see going on from Ukraine, led by the U.S. And we don't see it only in the level of massacres, like that horrible massacre in Odessa. I mean, we haven't seen anything like that in Europe since the Nazis. and nothing close to that. And but it's also at the financial level. This is a new kind of fascism in the sense that it's a financial fascism, and that concept, by the way, comes from Italian Minister of Economics, Giulio Tremonti. He said it's financial fascism. It doesn't need the Führer as a mask representing the people as one will. That's no longer needed now. We have the IMF and we have the machinery of state that is structured to bleed the people dry, and we've talked about that enough in past quarters programs, and of course that's the theme really of the cancer stage of capitalism, of all the mechanisms, instituted mechanisms to bleed the people basically to death. And that's what's going on with the IMF, but you still have the shock troops at the front. And you still have the big lie, the dry hate driver, the armed threat and war never stopping, the violating all agreements, the death squads, the mass murder. That's the shock troops to ensure that the financial hollowing out can go on in accordance with the new rules. And the new rules are basically to keep, you know, plunge people ever deeper into debt, and to, as not only individuals, but more importantly, societies, and strip all their social programs in order to convert the great last frontier of economic, for this money sequence system of public money itself, because everybody else in the majority has been bankrupted or made poor. So what they're doing now is raiding all the public sector and all the guaranteed incomes of the future through taxation and so forth. And that's what's happening in Ukraine behind the shock troop system that we see going on now already, bombing with artillery shells.
Indeed, John, we have to take a break. We should have music playing, but nobody's playing music to me. So I'll hum a few bars, beep, 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 and we'll take a break and come right back. John, we can talk more about Ukraine, and I very much want to, because there's so much going on, and enough for me literally to at least write one article daily, and often two articles, and some days even three articles.
Let's
You're
first
amazing,
jump over.
Well, I mean,
a lot
there's
of
so
facts
much, John.
Coming out.
I mean, there's so much stuff going on. I check my usual websites at least a dozen times a day because I spot new information, and some of it is important. Some I'll combine into one article, which I did yesterday afternoon. I try to sum up everything I knew yesterday that I hadn't discussed in another article I wrote, and I got it out in about 1,200 words. And I've got an article already written this morning on Ukraine, and I'm doing the same thing again for a second article on Ukraine. Again, because these events are going on, and I feel like I need to report a daily commentary on this stuff, because so much of it, if you put it together, it's so important. Let's quickly, we'll come back
to Ukraine. And no one else is doing it in the main press. That's why it's so important for you to do it, Steve.
Oh, what they're doing, John. We know what they're doing. They turn
it's
the truth
lies,
on its head, and
out.
They report the bald-faced lies that you and I talk about. Let's talk a little bit about Venezuela, because to a much lesser extent, we see a similar scenario playing out there. You know, America's scheme for regime change, getting rid of a democratic government, putting in a fascist police state, replacing it, and that's what's going on. There's a big difference between Ukraine and Venezuela. The vast majority of Venezuelans want no part of the right-wing fascists, and the violence that's taking place in Venezuela is really in some selected areas, in a couple of provinces, maybe two or three provinces, in well-to-do areas, either middle class or upper class, in the ordinary people of Venezuela. There's no violence there. They support the government. They support Bolivarian freedoms and all the benefits they get that they never had before. And the last thing they want is to see this replaced by the fascist elements that are targeting them to get rid of all these things and institute their own hardline policies. So again, it's similar in some respects to Ukraine. It's much different in others than Ukraine. And the Venezuelans are going to prevail. I think the Ukrainians are going to prevail in the end also, including people in the West, when they find out how badly they've been had. Again, they found it out once. Memories are short. Talk a little bit about Venezuela.
Well, you know, the methods are the same, Steve. You know, the street demonstrations that go on and on, the sniping that goes on, the media campaign of hatred of the leader, the opposing leader, just nonstop hate, the basically hiring of people to do deeds of violence, since you've got. So you've got the methods are basically the same, and then of course financial sabotage and just destabilization and society wreckage in general is happening in both places. But Venezuela is far more advanced socially than Ukraine is. I mean, in the sense that it's moving towards another level, whereas Ukraine has been in steep decline ever since they destroyed the Soviet Union. It's lost 65% of its whole GDP, disappeared, and they are, you know, in a sense, still in a basket stage, and you just want to take the rest away from them. Whereas Venezuela is rising. Venezuela has, it's halved its unemployment under the new regime. Here's an interesting one. It's doubled its oil exports under the new regime. Four times. It's quadrupled its oil exports, because you always get the sense that, oh, they don't know how to do things. You need the majors in there to get the oil for them and to sell it abroad. It's a matter of productive efficiency, which is one of the big lies. They've quadrupled their oil export. And the literacy, of course, they've halved the illiteracy rate. They've halved or even cut to a third the poverty and extreme poverty rate. They've got free university. They've got subsidized food, and that's the thing that's being exploited now. The subsidized food gets in, you know, people are buying the food and then selling it for 10 times the price in Colombia and so forth. And all of this is, I'm sure, part of the mischief that's going on the ground, because the U.S. has this system in the Ukraine, or it could be Thailand, it could be anywhere, and certainly more so, but more, very cored right now in Venezuela and Ukraine. They have this system that basically you can send in your covert operatives of every kind, beginning with the Endowment for Democracy and American Aid, basically just propaganda money worth billions, going in there just to produce the big lies, as all people hear through the media, which the media are still controlled by the oligarchs in Venezuela, and they just carry on in the very same way as we find in Ukraine, only here it's so much more obviously against the interests of the people. But who cares? Who cares? They've won, you know, the last 29 or the 30 elections have been won, and then it's gone right back to 1999. Democracy has nothing to do with what they're willing to do. The leader, what's happening now, and here's, I think, a shift in policy that's happening now with the U.S., because the U.S. is running and financing all this stuff, just like they did in 2002, is they're making two parties. The U.S. controls the parties of destabilization, all of them on different sides. So it controls, finances, those, who are what called the people who don't want to be extreme, who want to go the democratic path, and that's Capriles, and then there's those who want to just do a fascist thing like they've done in Latin America for the last 50 years, U.S.-led fascism. They want to go that route. You know, the Chile route, you might call it, or the project, you know, that went for the militaries of all Latin America. They want to go that way. So but both sides are U.S. funded. And but when you get close to what this division is, Capriles is himself a thug. I mean, he was part of the coup. He invaded, as you know, he invaded, went into the Cuban embassy and started to, I think, destroy files and threaten people after the coup in 2002. He's got the ex, director of intelligence on his side. He's a thug, but they're playing the Democratic card. They have to play the Democratic card still, as they're laughably doing in Ukraine. You know, while they're unloading cannon on them in the east, they're saying, let's have a vote, let's have a vote. Don't disrupt the election, Russia, don't disrupt the election. It's just like beyond belief, you know, the nature of the big lie. So they're doing this with the so-called democratic wing of the opposition, in which is led by itself by a coup thug, Capriles. So what's happened now, though, once they brought in the, once we bring in UNISIR into it, and we get the Vatican, too, sitting in on the talks, UNISIR is an organization across Latin America that Venezuela has been very instrumental in supporting, and indeed provides the banking, much of the banking money for its central public bank. UNISIR is actually representing the new Latin America, you know, which has its different degrees. Brazil is on that peace committee too. And you have the Vatican. Well, they're gonna see, they're not gonna be taken in by the American propaganda that everybody else is always taken in by until it starts to hit as it is now. We are now going through a world awakening, a world realization that we've never been through before. So this becomes clear to the so-called democratic wing of the opposition, in which has absolutely no concern with democracy at all. They just want to take away the power of the new socialism that has developed in Venezuela. And so what are you going to do when you've trapped, you know, you've been trapped into a situation as the opposition where you have actually impartial third parties listening in and watching it? They know they can't succeed with a big lie there, even if they own all the press and most of the press in Venezuela, and they own it all in the States and so forth, just telling the propaganda lies. They're not going to be able to get away with it here. And so that's why the talks have been suspended. I was waiting. You're not going to be able to get away with that here. And then sure enough, as soon as I had the thought almost, it was boom, the talks are suspended. They know they may not get away with it there. And so that's, and what I find interesting is that too, just like the shelling in Ukraine of villages and people on the outskirts of the city who have nothing to do with anything that could be called a rebellion other than that they supported, they're just voted, that's what they're being shelled for. The same thing where you know, it's never reported, is when they withdraw from the talks in Venezuela, that is the opposition led by Capriles, the past presidential candidate, nobody reports it. It's I can't find it in the Western news, can you? They've suspended the talks? You there, Steve?
Yeah, I sure am.
Yeah, I just wondered if you were able to find it anywhere in the news. I mean, you know it.
Oh, indeed. Capriles and Maduro were holding so-called reconciliation talks.
Yeah,
and,
but it was in front of UNISIR that was at least part of it, just coming due last Thursday, I guess it was, and maybe coming due, you know, was right on the spot. They were about to be there, and then they suspended the talks.
I know they were canceled, and I have no doubt that Washington is manipulating everything.
Oh, yeah, but what what's funny about, because you can't say you're democratic when you suspend the talks in front of impartial third parties who are democratically elected heads of state and their governments and the Vatican itself. You're not likely to get away with the same big lie threat system as you normally do. So what else are you going to do but suspend the talks? just as in Ukraine. What else are they going to do in the Maidan Square when it wasn't going anywhere in the sense of that they weren't getting the coup? Then they started shooting people, creating a mass panic in order to get the coup going. And so you see the same methods at work here. Claiming democracy, claiming participation, claiming peace talks, and all the while undermining them. And but you don't get to see the undermining. Maybe you didn't get to see it in Maidan Square when they started sniping at people and killing people and leading firebomb, just firebomb wars. And you don't get to hear that they withdrawn from the talks inside Venezuela with independent third parties. If Venezuela's government had withdrawn from the talks, it would be headlines in the New York Times and everywhere else about how Venezuela's despotism has stepped over the line and this is the end of the road. We're now dealing with a tyrant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They just don't mention it. That's what gets me. The selection by exclusion, the selection by silencing, and that's the one that occurs again and again, and that's what I see right at this moment in Venezuela. We have all that we've seen go on so far, and then we have crises being fed, about the food being sold at 10 times the price. They're also destabilizing the currency, shorting the currency, and no doubt flooding American dollars in there. They'll be, doing the usual destabilizations wherever, wherever there are problems, you can be sure that they're being fed. Not that all the problem comes down to that, but you can sure they're being fed. And then finally we get to the opposition gets the way. Finally we're going to have talks where they're, of course, going to basically try to just make the government look bad in order to provide the propaganda for another coup attempt. And then they withdraw from the talks. To me, that's highly significant, and no one mentions it in the corporate press.
Well, very much, John, absolutely. And you hit it just right. If Maduro dropped these talks, and of course Maduro is the victim, the ordinary Venezuelans are the victims of what's going on.
That's the key, isn't it? It's the ordinary people. It's regular people. It's a life and death contest. Everything this other system represents is to deprive the people of their life bases one way or the other. If you have to do it by burning them alive, do it. If you have to do it by having their pensions, do it. If you have, it's all about the means of life for people's lives, and one side wants to take it all so there is none. Basically, that's the direction and the trend. And the other side is trying to hold on to it, trying to advance it on the level of education, on the level of health, on the level of income security, on the level of gender equality. Always those are at war, whatever crisis we speak, whether it's Ukraine or Venezuela or who knows where next.
Well, so true, John. I think the Venezuelans will prevail in the end, but this has been going on over 2 months. There have been over 40 people killed in Venezuela.
Yeah.
I think in around Caracas, I think a middle class areas of Caracas. You've got middle class students involved, but you've got provocateurs that are really inciting everything that's going on. And Washington's dirty hands are manipulating this. It's so obvious. The same kind of stuff that's going on in Ukraine, except you have open warfare. You've got the military going after, against its own people. In Venezuela, you've got the military protecting the people. And most of the deaths were caused by these extremists that are causing the violence on the streets.
Report that much, do they? The police haven't been responsible for the death.
That's exactly right. And of course, in Kiev, when this extreme violence broke out in February, the Ukrainian police, special police, the so-called Berkut, they were remarkable in their restraint, and they were blamed for the murders that these right-wing fascists committed, and strong evidence, including video evidence, showed that they were responsible, firing from rooftops, firing from windows, from nearby buildings. But the opposite is going on in Venezuela. The police and the military are protecting ordinary people, and you've got these hooligans and these rich kids or whatever on the streets creating violence. A lot of them have been locked up. They let it get released. Who knows what they do? Do they go back out and commit violence again? I don't know. I think Maduro will prevail, but there's an awful lot of turmoil in Venezuela going on.
Yeah, and then when you take the objective that's always achieved, even if they lose, as we see happening in Syria, the objective being achieved, whether it's even conscious or not, but the objective of a money sequence cancer system is to destroy the society itself.
Oh, so true, John.
And they're succeeding at that. Everywhere they fail, they're succeeding at that, destroying the society itself. It's a society destruction system. And try to find an exception. It's actually a very dark, I mean, when I originally sort of joined the dots, it just was such a dark, dark thought. But try to find an exception to it. That's all we do. It's destroy the society. And all we do is destroy everything that's been built up in the way of providing means of life for people by social means. That's the big enemy.
And what
and
is
that's
really
what they attack.
And in all these countries, John, Washington's dirty hands are manipulating everything, and the scheme in Washington is to get rid of sovereign, independent countries and replace them with pro-Western puppet regimes. That's
yeah.
exactly what went on in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya. That's Obama's scheme in Syria, with the country still in great turmoil, war going on, even though Syria's military it continues to rout these terrorist invaders. It's not the ordinary people of Syria that are waging this war
from outside. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean you've got some expats that are involved, but you've got a lot of fighters coming in from dozens of countries. They're recruited. Saudi money is behind all of this. They're being armed. They're being trained. There are CIA operatives in Syria, and tens of thousands of people have been murdered viciously.
Well, the jihadists too are being directly paid and hired by them.
Oh, they're being paid. That's exactly
and
right.
They're not even from the country. Yeah.
They're not from the country. I don't know what kind of a song and dance they're getting besides. Maybe they're just doing it for a paycheck. I think some of them are ideologues. I don't know. What motivates somebody to come in and risk their lives, go up against the military of another country for, what, $1,000 a month? I don't know what they pay these people, but they get an awful lot of them to come in.
Well, they get a lot more than other people get. I mean, that's how they usually do that.
Oh, that could be. Plus,
and there's no end to that money coming at them. And when you have, you see the problem. When you think of it, the U.S. is a gangster state. All it's going to do is not only just what you described, destroy the government and make a puppet government out of them, but rather, I think more deeply than regime change, is destroy the society itself. So that there's no society left. And then you can just, you know, as a cancer does, just gobble the leavings. And who cares? Move on to the next. And you just, you know, step-by-step machinations of basically consuming, devouring life organization on the planet. And the key with, and I'm sorry to use a model, but it's the only model that fits, the key is that the host body that's under attack doesn't recognize its attacker. And in the case of any cancer at social or cellular level of life organization, doesn't recognize it. But worse is that it can't recognize because the U.S. has carte blanche to go in with all its piles of fabricated money and bring in weapons, do anything it wants because it controls all the lanes of communication and travel, and nobody stops them. So they can walk into, if you gave me $1 million and said, here's $1 million, just go and ensure this meeting doesn't go on or this democratic experiment or this, whatever it is that you want to destroy. I mean, it wouldn't be very hard to do it. I mean, but that's, you know, these guys are very expert at how you destroy a society. You divide, all the things that we've described going on in Venezuela, because it's the same methods over and over again, and we've described in Ukraine. But they're allowed to come in and do it. They're allowed to bring in $5 billion into Ukraine and just corrupt its whole ideology through propaganda. Imagine that. And then that's said, oh, that's free trade, you know. you know, that's just an endowment for democracy and American aid. You're not going to stop that, are you? Oh, boy, you really are a despot. So they're able to march in like gangsters. They're able to march into a store and terrorize everybody around it and kill them if they don't do as they're told, and then just pick off whatever they want. And at the macro level, that's actually what's going on. And we don't really, there's no recognition, of course, in the corporate press that this is going on. Even in Canada, in Ottawa, I was surprised to see, there was a guy with an FBI jacket on running around telling people what to do. What's happening in Canada? You know, they can do what they want. And they can do it with, you know, with the new trade deals, so-called. They have a way of commodities and money demand can transfer across borders, you know, without any inhibition, anytime, anywhere, without end, and only building more and metastasizing further. So there's never stopping how far they're going to push this metastasizing of the corporate commodities and the bank. Debt money. There's just no limit in what we see.
Indeed, John, we have about a minute left. We've got about a minute left.
You go now, Steve. I'm sorry. I've spoken rather too much.
I just want to let you add any final important thoughts, because we do get to the end of the hour. It creeps up on us so fast, John.
Yeah.
And usually I'm not paying attention because I get so engrossed in what you and what other guests have to say that literally I hear the music and, oh, my God, I got to get off air. But I think we could wrap it all up by saying that literally we have cauldrons of violence going on in different parts of the world. Washington bears direct responsibility, full responsibility, I would say, for just about all of this stuff. And where this is going to end, I don't know. But unless we can find a way to stop it, the book that you contributed such a marvelous chapter to, the risk of literally unleashing World War III if we don't find a way to stop this stuff.
Yes, and the phoniness of this election, which is they're now promoting, they better not interfere with the election. The reverse projections, just again and again, that I wish Russia would come out and say, you better have an election with underneath the international monitors that is capable of being legitimate before anybody's going to pay any attention to the vote, even inside your country, even part of the coup part of the country that you've taken, to go right very hard after this so-called coming election.
Oh, indeed, John. I got to get off here. The election, in so-called election, the sham election in Ukraine, will take place in 1 week. It really is a sham election. Only coup-vetted fascists are allowed to stand for election. But we can talk about the election next time you come on, John. It'll be all over but the morning, and we can certainly discuss that, plus the latest events in Ukraine and a lot else. John, many, many thanks, as always.
Well, it's always been great talking with you, Steve.
We're archived on Thursdays and Fridays. You can find those archives in my archives on PRN's website. We're on live Sundays, every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.